Honors, may it please the court.
Let's wait just a minute, let everyone get seated. Okay, Mr. Hurst.
May it please the court. E.J. Hurst II for appellant defendant Roy Hebron. With me at counsel's table, along with on the brief, is Henry H. Lemoyne, Jr. Your Honors, this case is about a man getting punished for legitimate conduct and about the government breaking his promises. Roy Hebron was the mayor of Ball, Louisiana when Hurricane Gustav struck. In that role, he led a conspiracy to defraud FEMA, the Federal Emergency Management Administration, out of more money than the town was entitled to. The conspirators did this by padding their claims to FEMA, by overstating the actual eligible expenses, and by simply creating false claims. But everyone agrees that the town of Ball was legitimately entitled to some of the money that it requested. Still, the trial court included those legitimate claims in Hebron's loss calculations rather than, as the guidelines require, making a reasonable estimate of loss.
Well, let's talk about all this because, you know, you guys have read the record. We have not. But from the briefs, it seems that the record supports the fact that the probation officer could not distinguish between legitimate payments and those that were illegitimate. And there is at least an accusation that Hebron created his own problem by falsifying the records and not requiring employees to submit actual accounting of their hours worked and the equipment used. So in other words, there is no way in this record to verify what Mr. Hebron is alleging. And they did the next best thing, is they did the best, you know, they could with the record that they had. The other aspect of this, Mr. Hurst, is that Mr. Hebron did not submit an alternative loss statement or evidence. And so there's nothing in the record. We only have one thing in the record, and it's either yay or nay on what we have.
Yes, absolutely. The problem is, how do you estimate loss when you cannot estimate loss?
But from your perspective, what you're saying is, how can you estimate what's legitimate when there's no evidence of what can be legitimate?
The government did that. The government did that in a brief ordered by the court directed at restitution and the intended loss level. This would be at the record, full record, USCA 5199. It's in record excerpt 8 of our briefing, that the government provided a detailed analysis and did come up with an estimate that loss was, quote, over $70,000 but less than $120,000 in intended loss. So the government had constructed at least a reasonable estimate of loss, a reasonable estimate of loss that did in fact envelop the restitution duty, $105,000.
Probation and the court didn't accept it.
Probation did not accept that. The court clearly did not accept that, and we'll go in a moment to a different reason why that's a problem.
Mr. Hurst, let me make sure any documents you're talking about, this brief you're talking about, is that also referred to as a sentencing memorandum?
It is variously referred to the sentencing memorandum. The actual styling of it is government memorandum regarding applicable loss and restitution.
But it's not two different documents. It's not a brief that the government submitted for sentencing and a separate sentencing memorandum.
There was a second reply to our sentencing memorandum that the government presented. That is something that we had moved to strike, and the court allowed it to remain in the record but gave us an opportunity to respond.
But when you said at sentencing or whoever was counsel that the government's position is inconsistent with this sentencing memorandum, that's what we're talking about now.
Exactly. Exactly. Right. And the simple fact is the government, in submitting that document to the court, signed off on it as a Rule 11 matter. That was the government's best estimate of loss. And they did provide substantial documentation that would support and buttress their estimate in that document.
Now, in that plea agreement, there's also that the court didn't have to accept that.
Indeed.
And didn't.
And did not. So now that actually takes us to the second issue that we're here today, which it does sound like that's the theme of the day, is the whether there was an objection formally enough made. Our position would be we didn't sandbag the judge, that the judge was aware of the issue of the different levels that the government had inconsistent positions. There was, in fact, an address in the court specifically asked the government to reconcile its prior positions with the positions at sentencing.
And so, they did?
As far as the...
In other words, the as I understand it, and you correct me if I'm wrong, both sides can correct me if I'm wrong, but the $320,000 was the, quote, intended loss.
According to the probation office.
The $100,000 plus whatever it was a strict what we, I think the word was conservatively, prove as the loss. And as I understand the district court's ruling, is that he found, and I go back to this confusion, that the records here were so bad, and the guideline does allow the best, you know, evidence of the loss, okay, the best that they have, and the court found that the probation officer's estimation was the best. Now, there's one other thing around here that really makes a big difference, and that is he could have been wrong up to $120,000, and still at the $200,000 mark, still you would have had the same enhancement for offense level that would give this particular sentence, whatever it was.
Exactly, and that is actually why the concentration at the sentencing hearing was on the second document as opposed to the plea agreement.
The
plea agreement set our ceiling, and then we had the government coming in and saying, based upon this multitude of documentation, our best estimate of intended loss is 70 to 120,000.
But, you know, the question here is not whether the government is wrong. The question here is whether the district court is wrong. And that to me is, you know, you're focusing on the government, but tell me why the district court is wrong in finding what it found.
Indeed, and I believe it is, in fact, your opinion, U.S. v. Kerning, which says that loss...
I'm being cited all over.
Yes, okay. Well, loss must bear some relationship to the harm caused. You know, the calculation must focus on the harm to the victim. So that which is not harm is not loss. So to the extent that some of these benefits, and this is a government's benefits case in the guidelines, in the application notes to 2B1.1, that's actually application note 3F sub 2. In a government benefits case, the harm is the overage of what the recipient is entitled to versus what the recipient receives.
Well, counsel, as I understand it, between the two hurricanes, about $440,000 was paid to the city. So this 320 would be 75% or so. And it seems to me between what the government upper level says we can definitely prove conservatively was an improper payment, and the district judge, as Judge Garza points out, who we're really concerned about, looking at all this other evidence and the uncertainty created by your client and others who were in conspiracy with him, that was a reasonable determination. That this is not something to scoff at and to undervalue, and to the extent he even brought it upon himself, that's one of the penalties of criminal behavior.
Indeed, and the answer to that actually answers two reasons why the defense reacted as it did. The government's evidence, you know, while it might frame it as a conservative estimate, those were the facts that it could prove by a preponderance of relevant and sufficiently reliable evidence. That is the standard for supporting an enhancement on the basis of a proponent. So to the extent they could have put on additional evidence that proved more, the opportunity was there on numerous occasions. What we were left with was the documentation of $70,000 to $120,000 based on the reliable, relevant evidence.
What did the district court finally find as the loss?
320,000, whatever the exact figures in PSR.
So he found the intended loss.
Even after a discussion with the government discussing hybrid claims, where both the government and the court recognized that some of these payments were, in fact, legitimate.
Now, what's wrong with finding intended loss? If I'm not mistaken, intended loss is one of the measures that can be used in this, what is it, 2B1.1 type of loss.
Yes.
Tell me what's wrong with that.
There's nothing wrong with that. And, in fact, the government's position was intended loss is 70 to 120. As far as the court going above that, that would be fine if it could document a reasonable estimate that that was loss, that that was harm. Our position is that was not harm. That was a legitimate payment that needs to be bifurcated under the application note 3F2.
Are you suggesting that this was not relevant conduct that got it up to 320 or what?
I'm suggesting it wasn't criminal conduct. It wasn't wrongful conduct. It was legitimate conduct. Now, what I'd like to do, we're cutting short on time. I do need to also discuss the breach of the plea agreement. Despite the plea agreement where the government, as the court has recognized, said less than $200,000, less than being a ceiling, everything would be under $200,000. If it were a floor, it would be greater than. We lay forth in our reply brief at least four instances where the government actively encourages the court, urge the court to adopt the pre-sentence report. This is notwithstanding its plea agreement plus the submission it made under Rule 11 that the intended loss was 70 to 120 based on the available relevant reliable evidence. So to the extent we submit, we have shown that there was a breach. There was something there. Something different was urged. The question becomes whether there was a sufficient objection. Our position is yes, we did not sandbag the court as Puckett means to address and prevent. The court was well aware, in fact, there was a discussion on record about the inconsistent positions that the government took.
Well, counsel, it seems to me much different if you refer to the sentencing memorandum that the judge requested, give us your best explanation, both sides, on the amount of loss, and an agreement between the two sides as to what would be done at the sentencing hearing. And you did not tell the district judge, we have an agreement that they won't make these arguments. Is that fair? And you have to move from that and show us why you didn't really need that specific objection.
We do concede that best practice was not followed. Best practice is simple. I object means I object, full stop. So we concede that was not best practice. We do believe, however, that the submission to the court about the government's lower standard, the court statements in the record that it has considered everything, including both parties' positions, indicates that the court was aware of the plea agreement, was aware of the irreconcilable differences between less than $200,000 and plea support $320,000. So to the extent that would satisfy the purposes of an objection, it wasn't formal, it was not best practice, but the purposes were satisfied. But even under plain error doctrine, if that the objection was not satisfied, we meet the plain error standard. We've shown breach. There was open advocacy in four spots at least, urging the court to adopt this. There was a plain error. The breach of a plea agreement has been plain error since 1971 with Santabella v. New York. And there is, in fact, as the court's well aware, a litany of Fifth Circuit cases that discuss plea breaches. What this case turns on in the plain error context are prongs 3 and 4. Prong 3, can you show harm? Can you show that this affected the actual sentence, the outcome of the proceeding? Yes, we can, and that is, we do that with the court's own admission. This is full record at 505. I've noted the positions of all involved. I really have carefully reviewed every document in this case and every consideration that's been presented. The court acknowledges that the government's argument was considered, therefore did affect the proceeding.
I think now, the court is saying the opposite, which is that it looked at all the documents, it had looked at all the substantiation of the 320 and had determined that that was the correct amount of loss. I mean, the court was not bound by the agreement.
And that is true as to figuring the intended loss and making a reasonable estimate. But as far as the breach of a plea agreement, that's not the question. The question in a breach of a plea agreement is, did the government act in accordance with what it agreed to? You know, the court is not bound to accept what the government does.
I mean, the question is whether it affected substantial rights, and if there's not a showing that the sentence would have been any different, then prong three fails.
Indeed, but we do show that the sentence would have been different because this was a guideline sentence. The court figured the guidelines based upon the PSR's loss amount and then departed downwardly, specifically stated it was a downward departure for prior good works under, it slips me now, but it is in our briefing, I believe. But basically it was a three-month departure for prior good works. So it was a strictly guideline sentence. If the guidelines had not been urged to be the PSR, but instead the government had urged to accept their prior versions of the guidelines, the difference is four levels on that loss table, which translates to 18 to 22 months in custody. That is well within the range that this court found in U.S. v. John, which I do understand there is a dissent to that is very well taken.
It was a good dissent.
Yes, it was a very well taken dissent. However, it was a dissent. The law of the circuit is that the breach, the harm was caused. In the last 10 seconds, simply note, this does affect the fairness and integrity. Notwithstanding a very good dissent, the law of the circuit is there is a broad, generous application under the fourth prong.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Hurst. You've saved time for rebuttal.
Yes, sir.
Ms. Cassier.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the court. I would like to begin first with response to some of the things in the reply brief and defense counsel's comments regarding the breach of the plea agreement. The sentencing hearing can be divided into two distinct sections. Well, first, let's begin with the judge in March ordered the parties to file memoranda, and he wanted every bit of information he could. He requested attachments to it regarding the loss, and then he put a little blurb at the end there, and where did the money go? So he wanted to know everything he could know about loss. The parties submitted these memoranda, and they came up with, the defendants were $66,000, and the government came up with $70,000 to $120,000, and the PSR came up with $327,000. So the sentencing hearing was geared towards deciding who's right or who makes sense. Can anyone make sense of these diverse conclusions? And the sentencing hearing is divided into really two parts. The first part, in which the judge is trying to resolve the discrepancies between the defendant, the government, and the PSR. The government had submitted all its documentation that it had attached to its memorandum. Defense counsel submitted nothing really to support their conclusion. They argued against what the government had argued for. And the defense attorneys also filed objections to the PSR and its calculation of loss. The judge listened to all parties asking specific questions. He heard from the defense. He heard from the government. At no point did the government advocate for the $327,000 in loss. The government said that the PSR had used a reasonable approach to determining intended loss, which the parties agreed was the standard that should be looked for, intended loss. The government agreed that the PSR was one way and stated that its determination was based upon a very conservative estimate that it had made of intended loss, which was pretty much actual loss, because the government stated that restitution should be around, I think it was $105,000. And so the government was really looking more at actual loss than intended loss in its memorandum, but
counsel,
it had all the information there.
Counsel, excuse me. All the 120, 70 to 120, was the government's calculation, did it state in the sentencing memo attached or documents to support our calculation, that this is our best estimate of how much out of the total $440,000 was actually misdirected funds or actually fraudulently requested funds, and everything else, our best estimate is, would have been properly paid?
It's unclear what the government was actually saying. I think they were saying it is a conservative, and we can prove these losses.
Okay, prove what? Prove that this was...
Prove that this money was definitely fraudulent. And that's in the PSR also, the definite aspects. But the government also noted that there were some hybrid instances in which, because of lack of records, the town did not keep records. They either lost them, destroyed them, or just flat out did not make records of all of these timesheets that people were charging for. And as a result, there is no way to really prove who was actually working on debris removal, who was actually working on, it was with the police security issues related to that, or were they doing their regular job? Because they could not be paid for doing their regular job. There was some proof that some of them were not, but there was no way to absolutely say that this was the case. And the timesheets that were submitted to FEMA were prepared by Hebron and his administrator, I've forgotten her name, Kimball, I believe. And they were prepared by them and just submitted to these people to sign. So there was no way to know for sure how much of this may have been legitimate. There was proof that some of it was not legitimate at all, and some of it may have been, but there's no way to really prove it. And I look to what Judge Garza said about this cushion of roughly $120,000 in the between the 327 finding and the 200,000, which is the break point for the guidelines. So that amount of money would be a substantial amount. Going back to my first argument, the sentencing hearing consisted of this broad discussion of loss, how to calculate it, hybrid loss, what was totally fraudulent, what was not. At one point, the judge states his decision at page 488. So everything that the government said before then was invited by the court. The government was complying with its duty in the plea agreement to candidly tell the court everything it knew about the offense, and that's what it was doing in that case, was stating that this is one way to calculate loss, this is another way, the PSR used it a different way. When the judge decides that this is the amount of loss, I accept what's in the plea agreement, at that point the government is no longer arguing for loss. The government is simply arguing for a sentence within the guideline range that the judge has found. And the government's information that the government gave the court is not a breach of the plea agreement. It is in compliance with the plea agreement.
Well, counsel, let's say hypothetically that we don't accept that the government complied with the plea agreement, that it was actually a breach of the plea agreement to make the arguments that it did. Where are we in your analysis under, just strictly under, the effect of violating the plea agreement?
If the government did advocate for a higher, if you could say that they advocated for a higher than the 200,000, well, their sentencing memorandum does not advocate for more than 200,000. All the government is advocating is for that. You would have to go to the third level, the third prong, and that would be prejudice to the defendant. The court did not rely on anything that the government said in making the 327,000 finding. It relied on the PSR and stated that. So I don't think the court can be said to have relied on what the government said. The court questioned what the government said. The court relied on the PSR and not what the government said, even if the government did say, well, 327 is it. I believe the court was looking at the loss itself independently and what the PSR stated. And the analysis in the PSR is very cogent.
When was the plea agreement entered in relation to the sentencing memorandum?
The plea agreement was entered, I believe, in February. The judge ordered that the parties file a sentencing memorandum or file a memorandum regarding the loss issue. On March 2nd, the government filed theirs somewhere around March 15th or 16th, and then the defense filed theirs at the end of March, I believe. But then there were two sentencing memoranda filed after, I think, the second PSR. There were three PSRs. And I believe after the second PSR, the defendant filed a sentencing memorandum in which the defendant stated that he had received nothing, no monetary benefit at all from it. The government filed a sentencing memorandum proving that he had received some $3,000 or $4,000 and had the documentation to prove that he had personally received it, whereas he was alleging before that he had, in his sentencing memorandum, he had not. And that was the only issue the government addressed in its final sentencing memorandum. So there were two filed by each party, essentially. Then the defendant filed objections to the PSR, and they filed two sets of those. With respect to the loss, the intended loss was agreed by everyone to be the measure, and the judge heard testimony from McVeigh, the FEMA representative, concerning the hybrid losses, the totally fraudulent losses, and how they were treated, and he was able to look at the PSR and see that the probation office followed those analysis. Defendant has stated that it's a four-level difference. If the court could find that up to $200,000 is the amount of loss under the plea agreement, if he followed what the parties agreed to and not what the PSR found, it would not be a four-level difference. It would be a two-level difference. Defendant is arguing for eight-level increase for loss, and it really would be a 10-level increase. The eight-level is based on the government's first sentencing memorandum. Are there any other questions?
Thank you, Ms. Cassiera. Mr. Hurst, you save time for rebuttal.
Okay, the very first thing is we don't dispute that Roy Hebron created his own mess. There's no doubt about that. That's why he's a criminal defendant. The question is how much of his conduct was actually criminal, how much of it was legitimate. As far as the response to the court order, our job as defense counsel in an adversarial system is to put the government to its proof. We sufficiently answered the court that it chided us at sentencing for not being more detailed. But as this court has well illustrated, it's difficult to detail the loss in this amount, particularly when you're hoping to flush out the government's evidence and rely upon what they filed under Rule 11. So to the extent that we didn't go into detail, it was not a lack of candor as much as doing our jobs under the adversarial system. Now, the government does note that actually what was determined to be intended loss was pretty much actual loss. So, you know, that's a very candid analysis. You know, they're somehow interrelated because that is the best way we can get at making a reasonable estimate. Reasonable estimate is necessary. Now, as to not breaching the plea agreement, if I could make sure the record reflects, paragraph 9 of the plea agreement says, quote, although not binding on the court, the parties agree that the applicable loss amount is less than $200,000. When you go to, this is full record 199, the conclusion of their first sentencing memorandum, that is, quote, government respectfully requests that the defendants be held accountable for over $70,000 but less than $120,000 in intended loss and $105,536.40 in total restitution.
What did the government do in your view to breach that?
To breach that, we get to the sentencing hearing where they say, among other things, the government would urge the court to impose a sentence within the guideline range contained within the PSI report. At that point, it abandoned the less than $200,000 figure it agreed to. It abandoned its earlier loss restitution memo and said, we urge you to adopt the PSR's finding. The three others that they mentioned, you know, it's reasonable that the figure be used as an estimate, the PSR figure, and we think the court should use the intended loss amount rather than the actual lower amount.
Mr. Hurst, Ms. Gutierrez indicated that the court had already determined the loss, and all it was saying is that it should be within the guidelines. How do you answer that argument?
The basis of Fifth Circuit law at that point isn't that the government's free to argue in favor of a pre-sentence report. It's still bound to the terms of its agreement. At the best, the government could have done there was simply say, we take no position on where you go from here based upon our prior filings and the agreement in the plea. So the government is bound not to act just as much as to act when they bind themselves in a plea agreement. Now, as far as the two sentencing memoranda, the second sentencing memo that the government filed, that was a reply to what we filed as a sentencing memorandum as the court ordered. And in fact, at the sentencing hearing, the judge determined that the reply memo out of nowhere that we objected to and asked to strike was gamesmanship. In fact, the trial court changed its sentencing memoranda policies based upon that filing from the government. So, we have to be very careful about accepting one side or another simply at its word. This is a complex argument. Within that complex argument at the sentencing hearing, we see the judge saying, asking why there's a difference. And I have run out of time if there's no other questions.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Hurst. Your case is under submission, and the court will take a brief recess before hearing the final two cases.